Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, July 22, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Listeners, if your birthday is today, let's turn to see if you share it with actor Louise Fletcher is 87, singer Chuck Jackson is 84, actor Terrence Stamp is 83, singer George Clinton is 80, singer-actor Bobby Sherman is 78, actor Danny Glover is 75, writer-director Paul Schrader is 75, singer Don Henley is 74, actor-comedian-director Albert Burtz is 74, composer Alan Menke from Little Mermaid and Little Shop of Horrors is 72, musician Al DiMillo is 67, actor John Lingonzo is 61, David Spade is 57, and Selena Gomez is 29. All right, let's turn to the front page of the Waterloo Courier for Thursday, July 22nd. Our headlines read, Face mask rules meet resistance in schools. They were inseparable. Sources, Iowa plans to name football field for Duke Slater. We'll start with our lead story, They Were Inseparable. It's accompanied by a colorful picture of a father and son walking out to a baseball field. Father and son killed in Cedar Falls barn collapse, lovingly remembered by journalist Andrew Wind. Fairbank. Andy Kaufman was a family man whose enthusiasm for remodeling helped improve the rural Cedar Falls home where he and his wife lived with their five children. His 9-year-old son, Beckett, was a kind person, often found helping others. They were inseparable. Beckett loved his daddy. Kevin Kaufman, Andy's father, said in an interview Wednesday at his Fairbank farm. Kevin and two of his sons, Adam and Derek, talked with the Courier about the 40-year-old father and son who died Friday when a barn on their rural Cedar Falls property collapsed. A funeral service for them will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday at Orchard Hill Church in Cedar Falls. Andy and his wife, Brooke, have another son and three daughters. Andy was involved in coaching a variety of youth sports that Beckett and his siblings have participated in and was an all-around dad, all-around son, all-around brother, said Kevin. He loved his wife like no other. He was everybody's rock, including mine. I've got a lot of good rocks in this family. An obituary lists 7 siblings and 2 step-siblings in what Kevin called a split family due to divorce. But we didn't treat it like that, he said. We are a family. Adam added, he loved his life. He was always thankful for and had such a big family and were close to each other. He worked for an insurance company in Reedland and had a gift for sales, starting with cars and then farm implements, but hadn't entirely left behind the notion of living on a farm. The family was raising a number of animals such as chickens, goats, ducks, rabbits, and a tortoise. He wanted his kids to have the values we were taught as kids and the work ethic, said Adam. And they all did. They all have that. The family had lived in Cedar Falls before buying the rural acreage in about 2010. Kevin noted that at the time, the house on the property needed work. Fortunately, Andy was up to the task. He completed multiple phases of remodeling on the building. He had taken an interest in renovation work in 2004 when Kevin and his wife Denise bought a restaurant in Fairbank. Andy and his brothers helped remodel the building along with a cousin who was a carpenter. Andy, he just took carpentry and kept doing it, said Kevin. Recently, his attention was focused on the barn that had been moved to the property. Installation on a concrete pad was finished last week on July 15th. A day later, the structure collapsed while he and Beckett were inside. The barn was a dream of his, said Kevin. They were going to insulate it and have a place for all the animals in the winter. The family lived in the Dyke, New Hartford School District and held a gathering for students and family on Sunday. One of the kids at the event at Dyke called Beckett the bucket filler, recalled Adam, noting the student's explanation that he was always helping someone. He was a kind kid. Beckett always was trying to help people solve all their problems, added Kevin. He He and his sons thanked the community of Dyke, Fairbank, Reland, New Hartford, and Jessup, where Brooke is a teacher, for being supportive through the loss of Andy and Beckett. "The overwhelming outpouring of support," said Adam, "has been appreciated. It's just been amazing," said Derek. As of Wednesday, an online GoFundMe campaign to provide financial support to the family had exceeded $80,000. Adam said the last he heard, people had signed up to bring meals to Brooke and the children through the end of August. "That's just a testament to how many lives they touched, both Andy and Beckett," he said. "Our condolences." Our next headline on the front page of the Courier: sources, Iowa plans to name football field for Duke Slater. Trailblazing was an All-American tackle a century ago. Ryan J. Foley, Associated Press. Iowa City. The University of Iowa plans to name the field at Kinnick Stadium for Duke Slater, a trailblazing black player who was an All-American tackle a century ago. Two people familiar with the proposal said Wednesday. The people spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity because of the plan to honor Slater hasn't been announced. A university spokeswoman didn't immediately return messages seeking comment. The Iowa Board of Regents, which governs the university, is set to consider and approve a proposed facility naming, recommended by the school at a meeting next week. No details about the agenda item have been released. After leaving Iowa, Slater became the NFL's first black lineman and a pioneering Chicago judge, and he will be inducted next month into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Slater died in 1966 at the age of 67. Slater went to high school in Clinton and played for the Hawkeyes from 1918 to 1921. He helped the 1921 Hawkeyes finish 7-0, including a victory over Notre Dame and Coach Knute Rocky that ended the 20-game winning streak. He entered the College Football Hall of Fame in 1951. Slater played as a two-way lineman for 10 seasons in the NFL with teams in Rock Island, Milwaukee, and Chicago, becoming the longest-tenured African-American player of his era. Slater earned a law degree from Iowa by playing in the NFL. He later worked as a lawyer in Chicago and became one of the city's first black judges. The idea of honoring Slater at Iowa's stadium first surfaced more than 50 years ago. In 1970, the University of Iowa president Willard Sandy Boyd proposed naming the Hawkeye Stadium Kinnick Slater in part to honor the 1939 Heisman Trophy winner Niall Kinnick. Boyd's idea faced pushback from some fans, and a committee was opposed having a joint name. As a compromise, the university named the stadium for the late Kinnick and a residence hall for Slater. Slater Residence Hall, which has housed generations of Iowa students, was the first building on Iowa's campus named for an African American, but few students have knowledge of its namesake. As a black student, Slater himself would not have been able to live in a campus dormitory under practice in places at the time. The university in 2019 added a bronze sculpture to commemorate Slater and the 1921 team outside Kinnick Stadium. After protests for racial justice erupted across the nation and on campus in 2020, some supporters renewed their push to put Slater's name on the stadium. They argued that the 1970s compromise snubbed one of the Iowa's greatest black athletes and scholars. Changing the stadium's name can't change the past. However, it can make a statement about our identity as a university, community, and fans going forward, said university alumnus Cole Gromas, wrote in an op-ed piece last June. Last year's protest also prompted several former black players to call out the racial insensitivity they faced while playing under Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz, who apologized and made several changes, including acknowledging kneeling during the national anthem. An investigation by an outside law firm hired by Iowa found the program's rules perpetuated racial and cultural bias and diminished the value of cultural diversity and allowed coaches to demean players without consequences. A group of former black players is suing the program, and two top Friends assistants, including his son and offensive coordinator Brian Ferenz, for discrimination. Some rival schools are believed to be using the allegations against Iowa in recruiting battles. Some Power Five conferences, there is only one football stadium that carries the name of a black player, Iowa State, Jack Trice Stadium. All right. Our last headline on the front page of today's Courier reads, Face Mask Rules Meet Resistance in Schools, by Heather Hollinsworth and Tammy Weber and Todd Richmond, Associated Press. Students in Wichita, Kansas public schools can ditch the mask when classes begin. Detroit public schools will probably require them unless everyone in a room is vaccinated. In Pittsburgh, masks will likely be required regardless of vaccinations. In some states, including Iowa, schools cannot mandate face coverings under any circumstances. With COVID-19 cases soaring nationwide, school districts across the United States are yet again confronting the realities of a polarized country and the lingering pandemic as they navigate mask requirements, vaccine rules, and social distancing requirements for the fast-approaching new school year. The spread of the Delta variant and the deep political divisions over the outbreak have complicated decisions in districts from coast to coast. In some conservative states, lawmakers banned districts from requiring masks despite outcry from medical professionals. Schools are weighing a variety of plans to manage junior high and middle school classrooms filled with both vaccinated and unvaccinated students. I'm so frustrated that it's become a political issue because it shouldn't be. It's science, said Mary Tuttle, who operates an Indianapolis in-home daycare center and hopes the city's school requires masks for her daughters. She worries that the Delta variant could lead to return to virtual learning, which caused her 10-year-old daughter to become depressed and anxious last year. Another daughter will turn 12 6 days after starting sixth grade and will be vaccinated as soon as possible. Adding to the concerns and a rise in cases overall sharply in some states, including Arkansas, which won't let schools require masks, public health researchers on Tuesday called Arkansas's rapidly climbing infection and hospitalization a raging forest fire, and the state's top health officials warned of significant future outbreaks in schools. Arkansas leads the country in new per capita cases, according to figures compiled by Johns Hopkins University researchers, and it has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, with only 35% of the population fully vaccinated. In Mississippi, the leading health officials said Tuesday that intensive care units are full in 13 hospitals because of a surge in cases, and he provided an ominous warning in one of the least vaccinated states in the country. You all were going to have a few rough weeks, said Dr. Thomas Dobbs. Weekly tallies by the American Academy of Pediatrics, based on state reports, show that COVID-19 cases in kids increasing nationally in July after a couple of months of decline. Most recent data shows a 1% increase from July 1st to July 15th, representing 43,000 additional cases. The American Academy of Pediatrics on Monday recommended universal masking in schools, even for those who are vaccinated. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention this month recommended mask wearing indoors for students and staff who are not fully vaccinated. The vaccine is not yet approved for children under 12. It is shown to be safe and effective for younger ages. Vaccine manufacturers could seek emergency authorization this fall or winter. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingartner said the fact that some states refuse to allow mask requirements is just plain wrong. She said the organization has embraced recommendations from the CDC. But school officials say masking decisions have become complicated by conflicting advice from public health officials. School districts that can set their own policies are taking different approaches. In Detroit, public schools, everyone will likely be required to wear a mask unless an entire room is vaccinated. Officials are developing an identification system, perhaps by wearing lanyards, Superintendent Nicolai Vita said. Let's turn to some Cedar Valley news today for Thursday, July 22nd. Our headline reads, 4-H to Fork. Teacher, artist, baker discovers ingredients at Hartman Reserve by Melody Parker. Cedar Falls. Maddie Sinnott isn't interested in living off the land, but the berries, edible flowers, herbs, greens, and fungi she's been foraging this summer at Hartman Reserve Nature Center are feeding her passion for baking and photography. I'm a science teacher, and I thought it would be challenging and fun to forage for ingredients that I could use in baking. Photography is a way to document that, as well as getting more experience in nature photography. I thought it was a really cool idea to combine them in this residency. A science teacher at Hudson High School. Sinnott has done considerable research on forest-to-table foraging and numerous native plants available at Hartman. There are a lot of plants that are edible. The leaves, roots, tubers, flowers. You have to know what you're looking for and how to recognize what is edible and what isn't. Garlic mustard is a very invasive species, but it is edible, and I can imagine using it to make pesto. Clover flowers are edible and can be incorporated into baking goods, she explained. It's fun to get creative with elements in a recipe. What I can substitute. What if I use this ingredient instead of that? Or did this instead of that? You think about the chemistry involved, especially in baking. For the past 11 years, Hartman Reserve Nature Center has offered artists this brush with nature through their Artist in Residence program. The program gives individuals the opportunity to pursue a range of artistic disciplines while being surrounded by the reserve's landscape and wildlife. Previous recipients have included a fiber and dye artist, musicians, a composer, sculptor, and painter. It is open to professionals and amateur artists. Nature inspires art, and the residency gives an artist the opportunity to create something that has been inspired by nature and their experience at Hartman, said Connie Sobdova, development coordinator. Maddie's proposal intrigued the committee because of her interest in learning more about science through foraging, baking, and photography. Selected artists receive a cash award, along with the opportunity to present programs, shows, performances at Hartman Reserve. Sinnott, originally from Muscatine, graduated from the University of Northern Iowa with a degree in biology education, a minor in chemistry teaching. She has taught earth science, physical science, chemistry, physics, environmental science, anatomy, physiology, as well as STEM exploration classes. She forages in-step recipes have included making bread, incorporating berries she gathered in the woods, a huge hit with Hartman staff, teaching children to make snacks and sweet rolls using native forage ingredients, and catching wild yeast for a sourdough starter. Yeast is a microscopic organism that floats in the air. All I do is mix together flour and water in a container to start the culture, she said. She covers it with a light cloth and lets it sit at room temperature where yeast finds its way into the mixture and begins to grow and divide. Each day she feeds the mixture more flour and water, building the mixture that ferments and becomes frothy as the yeast grows. Over time, the mixture begins to develop a strong, bready aroma and forms a watery substance on top that is stirred into the starter. At some point, she may refrigerate the yeast to slow the process. Eventually, she will use the starter to make sourdough bread. Throughout her activities, she documents the process and results with photography. She also hikes in the forest, taking photos of flora and fauna, using various techniques and camera lenses to create art for her displays at the Hearst Center and the Waterloo Center for the Arts. I like to study the photographs and see what I've captured and see what inspires me to make, like pretzel roll-ups to mimic the look of the mushrooms I photographed. I've taken some gorgeous photos of deer, and I can see following the shape of the antlers to braid kolache bread. All right, other news in the Cedar Valley. The headline reads, Opponents criticize Cedar Falls Mayor's PSO plan. Sires and Blanford claim mayor backtracked from earlier support. By journalist Jackie Smith for The Courier. Cedar Falls. As part of his campaign for re-election, Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green in early July released his plan to reorganize the city's public safety department. The ongoing debate over how best to provide public safety services will likely be a major issue in November's city elections. The city has had a paid on-call program that cross-trains employees for both fire and police duties since 2005. But the Public Safety Officer Program is an expanded version. It theoretically allows for faster response times, more manpower, and a reduction in overall public safety cost. In a blog post on his campaign website, robgreeniowa.com, Green says aspects of the public safety office model are great. I fully support cross-training and believe our smart and motivated officers have the skill and will to serve ably in the capacity, Green wrote. But the mayor goes on to say the current model, first enacted in 2015 and fully implemented with the elimination of several firefighter positions in 2020, lacks inherent accountability. The public safety officers are maintaining the proper training to protect the community. Green proposes five actions, which he plans to bring before the council in January, should he be reelected, including restoring a firefighter's job classification. Green has said several times in the past he doesn't believe a PSO is equivalent of a full-time firefighter. He also suggests in his blog that there should be profession-specific physical fitness standards, that the PSO should be a biannual certification and not a job, that the public safety supervisor role should be eliminated, and that the public safety director role should be tagged on to the role of fire and police chief, with who gets the additional title and duties determined by the mayor. All five suggestions require city council involvement. According to the Green's blog post, and therein lies the issue for Green's plan, the majority of the city council supports the PSO model. Though each of the four council seats sets up for election, all occupied by PSO supporters, have candidates who oppose it. Not up for re-election, but challenging Green for his seat as mayor is outspoken at-large council member David Sires. Sires calls for separate police and fire departments and the elimination of the public safety director position. There are several reasons why having separate police and fire departments are superior over the public safety model that the city of Cedar Falls currently has, Sires wrote in a memo to The Courier. These reasons fall into the categories of cost, efficiency, accountability, mindset, and expertise. Sires says as mayor, he would reinstate independent police and fire departments, rehire full-time firefighters, return both the fire and police departments to PSO staffing levels, and eliminate all PSOs. Sires noted Green's latest plan seems to contradict the mayor's position on the PSO model earlier this year, when he authored a memo to the city council that accompanied a special report on the city's public safety priorities for the next 5 years. I endorse this special report as a clear roadmap for achieving the long-term success of the public safety model, as described and required by the city council goals and objectives document, Green wrote in a memo. Former council and mayor pro tem Tom Blankford, who is also running against Green, noted that in thanking those involved in the public safety special report, Green wrote that it developed a well-designed set of goals and objectives that are ambitious yet achievable. This new document seems to take an entirely different view, asserting that the dedicated men and women in Cedar Falls Public Safety Department can't keep us safe despite fully endorsing the model 5 months ago. Blanford said the mayor's plan is long on assertions but short on policy recommendations and fails to address the impact on the property taxes. He pointed out what he thinks is a contradiction to Green's plan to eliminate the public safety director position, but then asked the fire and police chiefs to compete each year to earn that title. It creates an inconsistent vision of a vital department, Blankford said. I can't imagine trying to plan for the future knowing your senior leadership could change every year. He also questions why the mayor is unveiling a new public safety plan now with the election looming, when he could have proposed it at any time in the last 2 years. Blankford's campaign website does not feature a specific public safety plan, but he was a PSO supporter when he served on the council. He said no leader should ever say a program can't change, but public safety is only one of a number of critical issues in the race. Just as important are recovery from the pandemic-caused recession, addressing a critical need for workers across many industries, and access to adequate social services, particularly mental health care. My goal as mayor will not be only to keep this community safe, but also ensure that everyone feels safe, Blankford said. Abby Finkenauer to run for Grassley's U.S. Senate seat. Former 1st District Congresswoman still sees a lot to fight for. By journalist James Lynch, Courier, Des Moines Bureau. Cedar Rapids. Nearly 7 months out of office, former U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer still sees a lot to fight for, and this time she hopes to take the fight to the U.S. Senate Chuck Grassley. Finkenauer is launching her Democratic campaign today for a return trip to Washington because politicians who've been there for decades don't really want people like us there because they think they own democracy and were silent when it was attacked. She includes Republican Grassley, who hasn't said whether he'll seek an eighth term in 2022. Among those entrenched politicians who are so obsessed with power that they oppose anything that will move us forward. They've turned our backs on democracy, she said in a campaign video. They made their choice and I'm making mine. Continuing a theme from her legislative and congressional campaigns, Finkenauer's Senate campaign focuses on working families who are oftentimes not heard in Washington. What's lacking in the nation's capital among Democrats and Republicans, she said in an interview, is elected officials who actually understand working families versus just reading about them. When you understand those differences, you understand that there's a difference between the policies in Washington, either making sure that you're able to fill your drug prescription that month, or to be able to have enough money, or to be able to take your grandkids out to dinner, Finkenauer said. It's quite frankly why we're doing this. Grassley response. Grassley's campaign committee said Finkenauer's agenda would allow the federal government to control Iowans' lives with more taxes, regulation, and big government. It's what likely to be a preview of what of the Grassley campaign strategy is branded the potential challenger as another out-of-touch, out-of-office Democrat, too radical for Iowa. That's why Iowans fired her just last year, giving her the distinction as the first member of Congress from Iowa to lose re-election after just one term in more than 50 years, Grassley Committee Advisor Jennifer Hines said in a statement. If you know Nancy Pulaski, you know Abby Finkenauer because she voted with her 93% of the time. A really tough year. The 2020 election was a setback, Finkenauer said, but didn't dull her passion to fight for working families. Hey, 2020 was a really tough year for Iowans. We had the pandemic. We had the derecho. I was focused on making sure we did our job and didn't focus on the division that oftentimes we saw pushed by the other side, whether it was conspiracy theories or what have you. Special interests who disagree with her votes to raise wages, strengthen labor unions, and reduce the price of prescription drugs spent millions of dollars, in my case, $5 million, to defeat her. Former state legislator Ashley Hinson returned the Northeast Iowa 1st District to Republican control when she defeated Finkenauer in 2020 election. But they don't get to stop people from stepping up from Iowa for Iowa, Finkenauer said. It's why I ran for Congress in the first place. It's why I'm running for the United States Senate. Finkenauer joins two other Democrats who want their party's Senate nomination in the statewide race, Manning Farmer and Cattleman and former County Supervisor Dave Malbauer and Glenn Hurst of Minden. Mulbauer has been actively campaigning since the spring. Grassley's plans. Seeing a year is plenty of time for a campaign, Grassley, who has held elective office since 1959, plans to announce in October or November whether he'll run again. That guy's ready to roll, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman recently said about Grassley. Other news in the Cedar Valley, Klein, mayor, should quit the ice cream business. But Mayor Hart says there's no conflict of interest, by journalist Amy Rivers. Waterloo, a city council member challenging the mayor for his seat in November, says it's fundamentally wrong for him to invest in a local ice cream shop. The mayor said he's done everything by the book. Ward 1 Councilor Margaret Klein sent out a news release Wednesday calling for the mayor to immediately divest his holdings in Two Scoops Ice Cream Shop at 403 Franklin Street in light of the city's proposed mobile food truck ordinance. Since taking ownership of the ice cream parlor, the mayor has advanced new licensing fees for food vendors, including ice cream vendors, which have the appearance of punishing his competitors, Klein said. Klein announced in June she would challenge Hart for mayor. Hart confirmed Wednesday he retains an ownership stake in Two Scoops, but said he clarified with the county attorney that his involvement in the business is legal and does not pose a conflict of interest. Like many of my predecessors, I am proud to be a small business owner in this community, Hart said in a statement. It has given me a better understanding of the challenges they face and how critical small businesses are to the health of our local economy. The food truck ordinance, which wouldn't go into effect until January, would mandate fire inspections and licensings for food trucks and carts, which would include ice cream trucks. The ordinance, if approved, would actually lower licensing fee for such businesses to $100 for a 30-day period and $350 for a 365-day period. Currently, food trucks need a transient merchant license, according to the city clerk, which costs $45 per day. All right, listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, July 22nd, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Waterloo, Daniel G. Vanney, age 65, died Wednesday, July 21st, at his home of cancer. He was born January 5, 1956, in Waterloo, the son of Walter F. and Loretta Mullen Vanney. He married Joe Van Even on October 24, 1987, in Gilbertville. Daniel graduated from Waterloo East High School. He was employed in waste management for the City of Waterloo, retiring in 2018. He is survived by his wife, Joanne, his son, Drew Vanney of Waterloo, his daughter, Shannon, and spouse, Tony Lentfer of Evansdale, three grandchildren, Clarissa, Wesley, and Jackson, three brothers, Terry and Barb, Ted and Marjorie of Waterloo, and Joe and Sue of Hillsboro, Oregon, two sisters, Teresa and Ken Kramer of Cedar Falls, and Rochelle Vanney of Waterloo. He was preceded in death by his parents, a brother, Chuck Vanney, and a brother and sister-in-law, Tom and Nancy Vanney. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 25th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Gilbertville, with interment in St. Mary's Cemetery, Gilbertville. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 23rd, at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 4 o'clock rosary. Visitation will continue for an hour before services at the church. Memorials may be directed to the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Cedar Valley Hospice, or Mercy One Waterloo Cancer Center. Condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgaruff.com. Carly L. Nelson, 88, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, July 20th, 2021, at Unity Point Allen Health Hospital in Waterloo. She was born January 9, 1933, in Iowa Falls, Iowa, the daughter of Glenn and Gertrude DeBerg Stockdale. Carly married David Brock on June 3, 1955. He preceded her in death on January 9, 1960. She married Merlin Smitty Nelson on April 13, 1962. He preceded her in death on March 6, 2013. Carly graduated from Appleton High School in 1951 and Allen School of Nursing in 1955. She was an RN at Allen Hospital for many years, and later the UNI Student Health Center, retiring in 1990. Carly was a member of the First Presbyterian Church, where she was an elder and deacon, and the Allen Nurses Alumni Association. She loved to piece quilts and work in her herb and flower garden. Carly is survived by her four children, Charlotte Brock, Raddy and Jeff Brock, both of Cedar Falls, Kimberly and Rick Miller of Newton, Iowa, Eric Nelson of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, nine grandchildren, five great-grandchildren, two brothers, Lowell and Dorothy Stockdale of New Bern, North Carolina, and Wendell and Jane Stockdale of Willow Creek, Pennsylvania. She is preceded in death by her parents and both husbands, a grandson, Andrew Brock, a brother, Daryl Stockdale, two sister-in-laws, Patricia and Evelyn Stockdale, and a nephew, Wendell Stockdale, Jr. Services will be held at 10:30 Saturday, July 24, 2021 at First Presbyterian Church, with burial at Fairview Cemetery, both in Cedar Falls. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Dahl Van Hove Show Funeral Home in Cedar Falls. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Allen School of Nursing Scholarship Fund or the church. Online condolences may be left at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Mary Anna Hadman of Waterloo was 72, died Tuesday, July 20th at her home. Memorial services will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Services on South Street. Public visitation will be from 10 to 11 Saturday at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. All right. Other news. Let's see what we have for some sports news. Baseball news. Heartbreaking finish for Tigers. Cedar Falls falls just short of second straight state trip by journalist Craig Seeker. Cedar Rapids. The mission seemed nearly impossible for the Cedar Falls Tigers, knocked off 2, 3, and 1 seeds in succession, all on the road, to earn a return trip to the state baseball tournament. The Tigers chose to accept the challenge, and after upsetting number 2 Urbandale and number 3 Iowa City West in Class 4A sub-state play, they were on course to punch their ticket to state. Number 5 Cedar Falls threw a major scare into top seed Cedar Rapids Prairie, taking a 2-run lead into the 6th inning before the Hawks rallied to a 4-2 win Wednesday night. The Tigers finished 18-21, but they played superbly once again during the playoffs and nearly earned a second straight state berth. "We were right there. We had the lead with 6 outs left," Cedar Falls coach Brent Williams said. "I'm very proud of these guys for how hard they battled and competed. I couldn't ask for anything more from our kids. They gave us all they had." Cedar Rapids Prairie, 32-8, advances to next week's state tournament in Iowa City. The Hawks won state in 2016 before falling in the sub-state finals the next 4 seasons. Prairie had swept Cedar Falls during the regular season, but had its hands full Wednesday. "We knew Cedar Falls had a heck of a team, and they were coming on late in the year after having some injuries," Prairie coach James Nelson said. "They came out ready to play, but have a great group of seniors, and they battled back. It's tough to win these games, especially when you play a good team like Cedar Falls." Cedar Falls seniors Zach Neese turned in a brilliant pitching performance, holding the Hawks to 2 hits, no runs, and 5 innings. Zach pitched his guts out on short rest. He went out and was awesome. He did a great job. Let's see, the article continues on page 2 of the sports sections. Prairie finally broke through offensively with 4 runs in the decisive 6th inning, highlighted by Nate Kuiper's 2-run double to left center field. Nissi struck out 4 in a complete game performance. This team did a great job. We are a scrappy team and we leave it all out there. We love to play ball and give it our best. We played our game. They have a great team and we just came up a little bit short. We have a great effort and I'm so proud of every guy on this team. Prairie pitcher Jackson Nova, University of Kentucky commit, also pitched well, although the Tigers did score twice against him. Cedar Falls opened the scoring in the 3rd when Logan Strasburger signaled and later scored on Gage Flancha's sacrifice fly. The Tigers made it 2-0 an inning later when Brody Bartlett walked, advanced to 2nd on a wild pitch, moved to 3rd on Jaden Kramer's infield single, and then scored on a ground out by Strasburg. Well, congratulations to the Cedar Falls Tigers. Tough year, tough loss. Also in high school sports, Go Hawks headed back to state. Waverly Shellrock takes out number 6 Webster City in 9 innings. By staff report. Webster City, a 6-run top of the 9th inning, helped Waverly Shellrock knock off 6th-ranked Webster City 9-3 in the Class 3A sub-state final Wednesday. The victory sends the Gohawks, 33-7, to the Class 3A state tournament next Wednesday in Iowa City at the University of Iowa's Duane Banks Field against a yet-to-be-determined opponent. Locke, in a 3-all tie in the 9th, Peyton Green led off with a bloop to single to right. Will Sobzi walked and Groan beat the throw to 3rd on Dylan Stockdale's bunt to load the bases with no outs. Carson Graven then walked to produce what was the game-winning run. Then, starting pitcher Chance Key delivered a 2-run single that broke open the floodgates. Ben Boosman added a run-scoring sac fly, and Andy Ruse, who reached on an error, eventually scored on a wild pitch. The Gohawks' 6-run rally came on just 2 hits, but they collected 3 walks, were hit by 2 pitchers, and took advantage of 2 errors. Boosman, who came on in relief of Key in the 6th, earned the victory after pitching 3 blank innings for Waverly Shellrock. The Gohawks scored 3 times in the top of the 3rd to take a 3-1 lead as Graven walked and scored on a single by Boosman. Boosman and Luke Schuver both would score later in the inning on a throwing error. Webster City tied it in the 5th on C.J. Heisler run-scoring signal, and Lynx, who finished 26-2, had runners on 1st and 3rd to the 6th with no outs when Boosman recorded a strikeout. Schuver then threw out Webster City runner, tying to steal 2nd, and Boosman escaped the jam by inducting a flyout to the right to end the threat. The Gohawks will be making their 6th trip to the state tournament and 1st since they won the 3A title in 2015. Independence Falls. Aaron Savarey struck out 13 and allowed just 4 hits to lead Dubuque Wallert to a 5-1 victory over Independence in Iowa's Class 3A Substate 3 championship game. Number 5 ranked Wallert advanced to the summer state tournament for the 8th time and the 1st time since going 3 state straight times from 2015 to 17. Independence ended its season at 27-14 and fell short of its 3rd trip to the state. The Mustangs had won 3 straight. Trailing 5-0, Independence finally got on the scoreboard with 2 outs in the top of the 6th after Savarey retired 10 straight. Trey Weber walked and Keegan Schmidt singled out before Mitch Johnson broke up the shutout with an RBI single through the right side. Savarey ended the threat by coaxing Prover Hoopka into a ground out to shortstop Carson Coomer. Well, good luck to all in the state tournament. Let's see what we have in other sports news. Here we have United States dealt a shocking loss in opener, Tokyo Olympics, by Anne M. Peterson of the Associated Press. Sweden didn't have to bunker down on defense against Americans this time. Steina Blockensteinus scored a pair of goals, and the Swedes stunned the United States at the Olympics with a 3-0 victory Wednesday in the women's soccer tournament. The Americans, ranked number one in the world and the favorite to win gold in Tokyo, were riding a 44-match unbeaten streak heading into the match, but Sweden, ranked number five, has been the United States team's nemesis of sorts in recent years. The Swedes bounced the Americans from the 2016 Rio de Janeiro games in the quarterfinals, the earliest the U.S. Olympics exit ever, by making a defensive stand. This April, Sweden played the United States in a 1-1 draw in Stockholm, which snapped a winning streak dating back to January 2019, when the Americans lost to France in the run-up to the World Cup. It was the United States team's only draw this year. "Did we expect this result tonight?" "No," said U.S. forward Megan Rapinoe, who did not start but came out as a substitute in the 64th minute with a 2-0. "It's frustrating, and," story continues on page 3, "and it's frustrating that it's Sweden. They found a lot of space on us. I don't even know how many goals we have given up this whole year. I don't remember the last time we gave up a goal, so to give up three is not great." Sweden's offense deserved all the credit. Blankensteinus' header into the far corner off a cross from Sofia Jacobsen in the 26th minute gave the team a first-half lead. The United States, which came out stale, had its best chance of the opener half in the final moments when Rose Laval's shot hit the post. Coach Velkorit Anderskofik made changes for the second half, subbing in Carly Lloyd for Alex Morgan and Julie Ernst for Sam Mewers. But Blankensteinus scored again in the 54th minute, beating goalkeeper Alyssa Naylor as the Americans continued to struggle. Lena Hurtgut added the final goal in the 72nd. Sweden goalkeeper Hedvig Lindvall acknowledged the win over the favorites was encouraging, but it's still just the beginning of the tournament. Ahead are games against Australia and New Zealand. The Swedes were without Mega Eriksson because of injury. The team said she has been training, but because of the compact schedule of the tournament, she was held out at the opener. Tokyo is Sweden's seventh Olympics, after getting eliminated by Sweden on penalties in the quarterfinals 5 years ago. U.S. goalkeeper Hope Sola famously called the Swedes cowards for their defensive tactics. Sweden went on to win the silver medal, losing to Germans in 2-1 in the final. The United States has been to all seven Olympics and have included women's soccer, winning 4 Olympic golds, more than any other nation. The team is vying to become the first to win Olympic gold following a World Cup title. In 2008, the United States also lost its first match, 2-0 to Norway, but went on to win the gold medal. "I think ultimately as an athlete, you go through ups and downs, and this is a hard result, but it's the nature of a tough tournament," U.S. forward Kristen Press said. It wasn't going to be easy. We weren't going to breeze through 6 games no matter what, so here we are." It was just the 6th time that the United States had lost by 3 or more goals. Sweden now leads Group G, heading into Saturday's game against Australia in Satamata, while the United States faces New Zealand at the same stadium. The top 2 teams in the group advance to the knockout round. "It is what it is," she said. "We got bopped and we have 2 more games coming quick and fast. And now we know exactly what we need to do. We need to win these games and eventually get out of the group and go from there." All right, listeners, it's time to start wrapping up today's reading of the Waterloo Courier. We'll go to my favorite part of the paper, and perhaps it is yours too. Call the Courier. Does the governor's husband have a job? Answer. According to the governor's office, Kevin Reynolds retired in March 2017. Before that, he earned his bachelor's degree from Iowa State University in agronomy. His first job was with the Pottawatomie County in Soil and Water Conservation as a resource planner. He also worked at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, first as a soil conservationist and later as a district conservationist. As first gentleman, his focus is on preserving and enhancing Terrace Hill, the governor's mansion. Question. The old Hell's Road on South Hackett is now closed off. Is it used as a trail now? Is it prohibited to go in? Answer. From the answer from Steve Walker, a draftsman of the City of Waterloo Engineering Department, I believe the caller is referring to North Hackett Road, north of Rainbow Drive to the Cedar River. Yes, the vacated North Hackett Road, north of the Trolley Trail Bridge, is now part of a trail into the Sherwood Recreational Area. Yes, you would be permitted to go in by walking or bicycle. Question. Who paid to have the American flag printed in your paper on July 4th? Was it a two-sided printed page? Answer. We did not have a specific paid advertiser sponsor for the flag in the Courier. There were several businesses that participated in the Happy 4th of July ads that appeared in that section of the Sunday, July 4th edition, but none tied directly to the flag. Question. Has there ever been a pro golfer get two holes in one in the same tournament? Answer. According to PGA Archives, three players have recorded two holes in one in the same round on the PGA Tour. Bill Wheaton did it in the first round of the 1955 Insurance City Open. He was an amateur in 1955. In what is now the Travelers Championship, he first aced the 160-yard number 5. He later had a hole-in-one on the 208-yard number 9 hole. Yasuka Matsukatoa accomplished the feat in the second round in the 2006 Open and what is now the Barracuda Championship. He had holes-in-one on the 230-yard number 7 and the 173-yard number 12 at the Montrex Golf and Country Club outside of Reno, Nevada. Most recent was Brian Harman in the fourth round of the Barclays in 2015. He aced the number 3 at Plainfield Country Club in Edison, New Jersey, and then had another ace on the 228-yard number 14. Question. I was under the impression that the child care tax credit deposited would be $300. I received $600 and only have one kid. Did they make an error? Answer. Under the tax credit that is part of the American Rescue Plan, parents will receive a monthly payment of as much as $300 per child for little ones 5 years old and younger. The expanded credit is up to $3,000 per child a year for children 6 to 17. The credit offers an extra $600, providing up to $3,600 for each child 5 and under. Question. On which side of Highway 63 Railroad Bridge are they building something? What is it? Answer. The structures at the four corners of 63 and CN Railroad overpass will be decorative monuments and are part of the U.S. 63 Enhancement Project, according to Dennis Gentz, Assistant City Engineer. Calls are taken on a special courier phone line at 234-3566. Questions are answered by courier staff and staff at the Waterloo Public Library. And last, listeners, I'll leave you with an announcement for Ron Heckroth's open house. Ron Heckroth will be celebrating his 81st birthday with an open house on Sunday, July 25th at Antique Acres at 7610 Waverly Road, Cedar Falls, Iowa. The open house will be held from 4 to 6 with potluck supper at 6 p.m. Meat, drinks, and table service will be provided. Please bring a dish to share. Ron requests no gifts, and cards can be sent to 2649 Hawthorne Avenue, Janesville, Iowa, 50647. Happy early birthday to Ron Heckroth. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, July 21st, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading at our website at iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thanks for listening.